Welcome back, WNST, TASS in Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I have promised to keep calm and stay completely local, and I saw this guy watching a little memory of ours from about 25 years ago last week on ESPN. My whole world during the middle of a pandemic was watching Cal Ripken's 21-31 game, and I said, you know what? I'm going to throw Cal a note, see if we can get Cal on, surprise Don Moeller. So lo and behold, Don Moeller here on Baltimore Positive. We have Cal Ripken today. What do you make of that?
It doesn't get any more Baltimore Positive than that. And Nestor, as you know, and Cal, welcome. But as Nestor knows, I've got grandchildren that are absolutely, and Nestor says they're rare commodities this day and age. But my grandchildren are absolute baseball fanatics. They're in withdrawal because none of their teams are playing. I've got a 13-year-old who absolutely just lives and dies for the game, as well as my other grandchildren. So this has been tough for them. So when they find out that we were chatting with Cal Ripken, they're going to go through the roof. So it's great to talk to you, Cal.
Hey, guys, can you believe it's been 25 years? 25 years. I kept looking at Chris Berman and Buck Martinez because I never really sat down and watched the broadcast. And I went, man, those guys look young. And then I looked at myself and I go, well, I look pretty young myself.
Well, you know, Cal, I remember the calibration in Baltimore County like it was yesterday, and putting the number 8 in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue and Chesapeake Avenue, and just an incredible experience the whole thing was. When you look back, Cal, just when you said it's 25 years, and we'll talk about when ESPN rebroadcast it last week and the effect it had in this household. But when you look back, what do you remember, not only from the streak, what do you remember in the rearview mirror about that night?
Well, I've been asked a lot about that here lately, just because it's the 25th anniversary and it did play on ESPN, so it was on a lot of people's minds. And they want me to pick out one particular moment in that. For the longest, longest time, I refused to look at any video footage of that. I just wanted to preserve the experience through my own eyes. It was that surreal. It was that different of an experience on the baseball field, and I wanted to preserve that. But over time, I started looking at the replays of it. I watched a little bit of it, then channel surf and come back to it. This past time, I just sat down and watched the whole thing, and picking up new parts. I mean, the people that they interviewed. I learned about that Earl Weaver, when he moved me from third to short, and his memory was very accurate, is that one day I just came in, there was a 6 next to my name instead of a 5, and I thought he just made a mistake. But he said, I didn't want to mess the kid up, but I was just hoping to get through the weekend. So that was the first time I realized that maybe to him it was going to be a temporary move. I went over there thinking, this is where I'm going to play. And that temporary move lasted 15 years. So that was really interesting to me to have that perspective from Earl. To see Joe D, to see Hank Aaron, two guys that I've had a chance to spend some time with, but they're truly baseball royalty. And to see them at the game, that was really cool for me. That was something wasn't in the forefront of my mind. But the coolest part to me when I rewatched it was when the moment that I looked up and caught my dad's eye, and it was after a pretty decent amount of celebration that was going on, and the curtain calls coming out almost saying, thank you, but can we get this game started? That was how I was feeling. And then I looked up and saw my dad. And my dad wasn't someone that said, I love you, but you knew he did. And you knew that he took special pride in my accomplishments. And so at that moment, there was 1,000 words that were flying between him and I, which still gave me goosebumps. And I know we get a little softer as we get older. I tend to cry a whole lot more watching movies now, but tears came up in my eyes. That was a pretty powerful moment.
Well, that full disclosure, Cal, that is the moment. And it's so interesting that you zero in on that moment, because it is that moment that the waterworks opened up here in Catonsville. And I texted Nestor.
He was blubbering, Cal. He was. He blubbered right on the text. It did.
Part of the reason, Cal, and you've alluded to this, maybe you can expand upon it a little bit. I said to my wife, I said, just look at Senior. I was looking at him thinking of myself as a granddad and a dad, and I looked at your father, and I said, "Mom, I didn't know your dad." I said, "But everything I've read is that he's not a guy prone to superlatives. He's not a guy who's particularly outwardly emotional." And he just looked at that moment like a man who was sending you psychic vibes saying, "Son, I'm so proud of you." I mean, just that's what came through that moment to me on the TV.
Yeah, I mean, you described Dad to a T, I think. You know, that generation wasn't, huggy and mushy and I tell my kids all the time, I love them. I don't think it's because you didn't get it, you know, when you were growing up. It was just, it's a different generation. The communication is much different. But you can tell when I hit a home run and came around third base, especially the first one, and the first person's hand I shake on that first home run was my dad, who was a third base coach. You know, he always had a special handshake and a special look at me that I knew was different than anybody else.
Cal, when you found this game was coming back on in the middle of the pandemic, you talk about social distancing and, you know, and your dad could social distance a little bit as well. For you sitting at home with the dog and for it to pop up for me, I think everybody was watching it, but we're all looking for something to do with, I mean, I think we're all getting a little stir crazy, right? So, and we're all getting stir crazy for baseball specifically for all of us who've had this sort of clock going on. Was it, when you heard they were showing it, is that a good emotion for you to want to sit there and watch it for a couple hours? Or is it, I think there was a time in your life where it's not again. Now, all these years later, it was a wonderful night to sit around and watch baseball for everybody in my life who hasn't had a baseball game to watch, right?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of reasons. I mean, I sat around and shared that experience with my wife, Laura, and she hadn't gone through that, and it was fun to do that as well. But, you know, the interesting timing part, and I think a lot of times things that happen in life are a matter of timing. You know, we sat around as a foundation, and we started to think, how can we help? How can we put our foundation to use during this time off? And the idea came to help with the food insecurity. Because food is a big issue. They rely on, a lot of the communities rely on schools, rely on Boys and Girls Club. And we made a decision we were going to turn our focus from our foundation, this national focus that we built with our resources and our partners, we would focus on that to try to help during this time. And right around the same time, ESPN decides that they're going to place the game in there, which started to receive a lot of attention. And my intention was to go on social media, maybe to reach out and ask people, use the power of social media, because I've never been on. And I always thought that you had to be a little bit more outgoing to make that work. And I was, private, although I lived a public life, and I still do. I'm more of a private person. But I thought, what a great cause. What a great way to use social media. And then all this attention was poured upon me, you know, from the 21-31 game. And so I looked at it as the timing was really good to get a message out, not only to talk about 21-31 and really feel good about that accomplishment and soak in some baseball when baseball is not being played, but it really gave a platform and an opportunity, you know, to talk about what we were doing with the foundation. And our Strikeout Hunger campaign has been marvelously successful so far. Even the smallest of dollars matter, you know. Feeding America is our partner, because we didn't know anything about food distribution, but they do. And so we reached out to them. They told me that $1 given is 10 meals distributed. So if you really think about what $10 can do, just think $10, people have to kind of throw that away and not even think about it. But $10 is 100 meals, you know, in those neighborhoods. So when you start doing that, we've got a lot of smaller donations, but the smaller donations have added up to big dollars, and we're helping a lot of kids.
Cal, your family and baseball and all that it's meant to you, I think there was this dream of Don and I that you were going to run first you were going to be the manager, then you were going to be the general manager, then you're going to be the president, then you're going to own. We had all of these thoughts about all of this, but from baseball and from what you've done for children over the last 25 years at Cal Ripken World Series, and more than that, I want to bring your brother into this, because sometimes that bat shows up with that, you know, the thing underneath it. It happened the other day on my Facebook the other day. But your brother is also an incredible ambassador out of Major League Baseball Network every night, because you said you're more private. He's been out in front of baseball every night for most people in a way that maybe people wanted you to be, or the way A-Rod is out in front of it a little bit more. But the Ripken family and baseball through all of this, where that night was in 95 and what your father's legacy for you guys wanted to be, we had it all painted up in our cartoon world. The last 25 years, I see you out. It's been unbelievable for the Ripken family, I think, and for baseball, and for your foundation and the good work you do that pops up all the time, you know?
Yeah, I thought when I left baseball that there would be an opportunity to come back to Big League Baseball, and in particular with the Orioles. My first priority was to be there for my kids. My kids were 8 and 12 when I retired, and I wanted to be there in ways that my dad couldn't be there when he was when I was growing up. You know, he was in the minor leagues for the first 14 years. He had to work in the minor leagues, go to spring training earlier, go to instructional league, work two or three jobs in the off season, you know, so he was constantly providing for the family. But I had choices, and I wanted to be there during those years where I could pack lunches and take him to do the to school, where I could be an assistant coach for Gilman with Ryan, watch their athletics. And going back into the grind wouldn't allow that to happen. So I knew that by going away from it for a while, there was a risk that I wouldn't be, you know, welcome back. But I still think I'll turn 60 this year, and I still think that there's a possibility at some point that I can make a contribution back to the big league game in some way, shape, or form. And watching the Orioles rebuild, you know, it reminds me of the painful rebuilding processes that we went through, and it wasn't fun, but it was really good to come out on the other end. I got a chance to watch Ryan in the minor leagues. He's doing quite well. He played in Double-A last year. He had 280, 282, I think. He's starting to show signs of power, which is really good. You know, looking at the young kids and talking to them and giving them some of the experience that I was able to have, and really just having a good conversation with Ryan, I still think that there's some value. And so maybe, but life takes you on different paths. And sometimes it's not all about you planning it all out perfectly. It's taking advantage of the opportunity and the journey that you're on. And I feel very proud of being able to use the foundation in Dad's name to help a lot of kids, you know, a lot of kids that don't have all the same advantages. Well, I'm very proud of that. And I'm very proud, you know, of our kids' business success. You know, we have three complexes. Actually, if you count Disney, that's four complexes. We're looking to expand on our successful models in Aberdeen, Myrtle Beach, Pigeon Forge, and Orlando. I'm very proud of that because it gives a chance for kids to experience maybe a big league experience where most kids don't get a chance to take it much further than that. But we feel good about all we've been able to accomplish. And when you talk about Billy, Billy is fantastic in that role that he has in the studio. I mean, he has a perspective, a really great baseball perspective. He has an outgoing personality in which he delivers it really nicely. He's content. He's happy, I think. And he does weigh in on all the issues on a daily basis. So when I want to know about baseball now, I'll call Billy up.
Well, speaking about baseball now, Cal, people, and for those of you tuning in, we're with Cal Ripken, the one and only Iron Man, those of us who grew up with Oriole baseball forever in Cal's debt, as is all of Major League Baseball. But, Cal, you truly bridge, since you have Ryan in the minors right now, so he's baseball 2020. And you bridge, you know, a few decades ago. What's your take as a dad and a player and someone who loves baseball on the whole analytics perspective that's so much a part of the game today? How do you sort all that out? What does that mean to you?
Well, you've got to know me over the years, and I think the best way to describe me is I am very analytical. And I used all the data that was available to me, all the patterns, all the things that you could use. I love data. And the problem with a lot of the data is they're measuring all kinds of things and they're searching for answers or directions or way to teach or what does that data mean? And I think they're applying some of it, in a really effective way. But in the end, data is only as good as how you can help a player become better. And sometimes I can say that being analytical and being able to analyze all the situations was a tremendous value to me. It was a tremendous strength, but also it was a weakness because I could overanalyze something. And I tend to worry that with all the different forms of measurement now and all the different ways in which we can measure it, we're trying to say, what does that mean? That many times you're overwhelming some players and you're feeding them data and feeding them information. And maybe it's an overanalysis. So I see great value in a pitcher, you know, pitching. When a ball comes out of a pitcher's hand and it has a certain rotation and it has some late sink to it, you know, scouts used to say, you know, he's got movement like Kevin Brown or like Scott Erickson. He's got really late movement. But now you can actually prove it. You can see the rotation coming out, the spin of the pitch, and go down, and he can duplicate that sort of move. And so I see the value in that. It's a little bit harder applying all the analytics to a baseball swing because the pitcher is trying to mess up the hitter in their timing. And I would say no two swings are exactly alike. You want to get in position and give yourself a chance, but they're changing speeds on you, locations on you, sometimes 30 miles an hour difference between the fastball and the off-speed pitch. So your goal is to have a good chance, and but your swings are not going to be exactly the same, and each hitter is different. So it's very difficult to apply, you know, a metrics on hitting that applies to everyone. And I think you should keep that in mind when you're teaching. But I have no problems with the analytics. I love listening to them. I love listening to the logic of it, and then trying to use your baseball experience and your knowledge to say, does that fit? Does that work? Can you work with that? Can you help a hitter with that information that you got?
Cal, obviously the analytics and the cameras and all that, banging on trash cans, you know, two bangs is a curveball, one's a fastball, what, cheating, sign stealing, but more than that, the fallout of all of this and the institutional part of it. You were always known for fairness. You know, you were always known for playing by the rules, playing every day, every inning, all of that stuff. But the cheating part of baseball, from cork bats to, you know, Gaylord Perry to everything else that's ever gone on through the history of the game, we didn't even get to start the season this year, but certainly the last couple of months, I spent a lot of time talking about baseball and ethics. And I'm sure you've talked about it a lot as well, and your boy plays the game. When you've had something stolen from you, and I certainly feel like a lot of the other players in the sport who were playing it straight have been really angry about it. How would the 22-year-old or the 32-year-old or the 42-year-old version of Cal Ripken have felt about that as a player in the game?
I think perspective needs to be given on this. There's many of examples, and you just named quite a few of them. There's always been a cheating element, and some people in the game will say that it's to get an edge. If you're not cheating, you're not trying. Stealing signs, you know, from second base. Somebody in the game will say, look, I've earned my way to get on second base, and if you're lazy enough to not put your signals down where I can't decode them, then I should be able to use them. Now, I never gave a sign, and I never received a sign from somebody on second base. I thought the true sportsmanship or the true challenge was you and the pitcher, and not you and the pitcher and the guy on second base. So I thought, but there are a lot of people that think that's okay, and that's been happening in the game. There's teams that had that reputation that I could name, and I'll probably refuse not to name right
now.
We'll
leave the White Sox and La Russa out of this. Okay, I'm sorry.
So when you start to name, or when you start to look at that, when you play a team like that that has that reputation of giving signs, stealing signs, and all that kind of stuff, you have to be aware of who you're playing. And so you change your signs frequently. And sometimes in examples, if somebody's giving pitches from second base and say they put down a curveball and the hitter knows the curveball is coming, sometimes you just go in there and say, okay, put down curveball, but I want you to throw a fastball up and in. Now, I can assure you that when the hitter is looking for a slow pitch at 68 or 70 miles an hour and the curveball starting, you know, up and in and breaks over the plate, then all of a sudden they get surprised with a fastball up and in. Their life flashes before their eyes, and then they start to think, well, wait a minute, do I trust that signal coming from second base? And I would argue that you have the advantage now when you broke that trust, because when the guy gives you the sign, his first instinct is he right on this one or is he wrong? And being a hitter, you want to be for sure what you're looking for. You don't want to be caught in between. But there's all kinds of ways to deal with that. And in this day and age, the concern that I have is you can have camera angles. You can you can have algorithms that will decode signals better and all that. The digital aspects, and even there's some rumors that there's buzzers inside uniforms, and you're telling people that way. The technology and the ability to cheat seems to be there's more of an opportunity, more of a temptation, and that's not good for the game at all. You know, the game at all is a game that is real. It competes. And you're always going to deal with someone trying to gain an edge. And there's all kinds of things in the game that, you know, for example, if a pitcher tips his pitches to me, you know, remember Jack O'Connor was a left-handed pitcher for the Twins. And in his windup, when he took a fastball sign, he would take a deep breath and throw the pitch. When he took a breaking ball sign, he didn't take a deep breath. So his nickname became Huff and Puff really quickly. So every time he huffed and puffed, he threw you a fastball. So that's a huge advantage as a hitter, but that's just like the pitcher looking at where the hitter's standing, whether he's close to the plate, whether he's off the plate, and all that kind of stuff. So those things happen in the game that you naturally pick up. But when you start using all these different, like binoculars in the bullpen or in the scoreboard, which has been rumored, or using TV angles and Apple Watches and all that kind of stuff, that takes it outside the lines, in my opinion. So, but to say that it's just happening now would be untrue. There's been that sort of element that you've had to deal with when you play. And if you're the catcher and you hear the trash can bang in there and you realize there's a pattern going on here, because in order for it to work, the hitter has to hear it, right? So the catcher and the umpire are sitting in a similar location. If they can hear it, then they can turn it to their advantage as well. So, you know, they're talking about taking World Series away and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if fully you understand what that means or not. That's a very difficult call, but I think the commissioner is rightly, you know, putting a real hard penalty on that, because it's not good for the game. It's not good for the game to think that that's happening, you know, out there in the field. And I applaud the commissioner for the hard stance that he's taken.
Just to clear it up, you never cheated, right, Cal?
No, never cheated.
You did talk, though, Cal, about where a batter stands in the batter's box and so on. And I was thinking, it was funny, because of 21-31, the rebroadcast of that took place right about the time we lost another great Baltimorean in Al Kaline. And I was thinking, in terms of baseball, that if I look at Al Kaline's batting stance at 18, Al Kaline's batting stance was identical 20 years later when he left the game.
Cal Ripken, I know where you're going with this.
Cal Ripken, not so much. So for all those young kids out there, you're talking about analytics. Talk about what led you to change stances throughout your career. I don't know, there are 8 to 10. There are a lot of different stances, Cal. How did you make those decisions, or was it just intuitive?
No, it's first of all, a stance is just a starting position, and you can find all kinds of stances all the way through the league, and then you have to ask yourself, how do they have success with those stances? But they have the ability to hit, and there's certain fundamentals in the framework that you need as a hitter, but a starting point, you know, can make it more difficult to get into your swing. Like if you have way too much movement, those trigger mechanisms or those timing mechanisms, and the pitcher gets ready to throw, your timing might be off. So a principled way is the more still you are when the pitcher gets ready to throw the ball, the steadier your head is, and there's less moving parts to go wrong. But there are times when you really do need to trigger something in your swing. And I will tell you that maybe this logic started to happen because I played against Carl Yastrzemski. And Carl Yastrzemski, at the end of his career, I don't know if you remember, either 82, 83 range, he wore us out, at the end of his career. He had a long, long career, and he was swinging the bat really well. But I noticed that he was leaning out on his front foot and putting all his weight on his front foot as part of his stance. And then as the pitcher started to deliver the ball, he would go to the backside and then come forward. So I asked him when he got to second base, I said, why are you putting all your weight on your front foot? And he said, as I've gotten older, I get jumpy and I feel like I want to go out there, because I feel like I don't have the same quickness that I had before. So I try to make sure that I go back first, which is a position of loading to give myself a chance. And so I realized that as you play baseball, that you have to make adjustments. So my problem was I'd pull my shoulder, or I'd go out too soon, I'd charge ahead. And the counter to pulling your shoulder is to close it off. So you go with a more closed stance. Now, I would practice this in batting practice because sometimes I couldn't hit 60 miles an hour and think, okay, what's wrong with me? And then I closed my shoulder off and I stayed in, and all of a sudden things started to happen. And sometimes I couldn't understand why they happened. I just closed my shoulder and it started to work. So I went with that stance. And if you can't wait on the slow stuff or the breaking ball or somebody's getting you way out in front, maybe you widen your stance a little bit. You kind of anchor yourself so you wait for the ball a little longer. So there's some basic reasons why, but I wasn't afraid to try something to get myself out of that. I didn't change my swing per se, but I did change my starting position.
Really interesting. Yeah, the other thing I always think about, and I can't thank you enough for this, and I'll tell a quick Kenny Singleton story one night. When my son was playing Little League growing up, it was at Singleton's best years in Baltimore, and I always appreciated the way Ken carried himself. And, you know, I went up to him one night at an event, and I just said, "Hey, Ken, as a parent of a young kid, I just want to thank you for the way you carry yourself." And typical of Singleton, he looks back at me and goes, "No," he said, "I want to thank you for taking the time to come up and sharing that." And that sort of Ken Singleton playing the game the right way, going back to your dad again, we always hear that Cal and Billy play the game the right way. Again, this is really a question for my grandsons, again, who love the game. What does it mean? Oh, and they've been to Ripken Camp, by the way. They've been up to Aberdeen. They love coming up there. What does it mean for you to play the game the right way?
Well, do what my dad said. No, I think we all have a standard that you give yourself and a conscience, you know. And many times within the game, there are no written rules against some of these things that some people can call cheating or some people can't. I had my own standard, my own sense of what I thought was right and what was wrong and what was fair in competition. And I tried to live to that standard, and I got that standard from my dad. You know, if you think about it, and maybe this explains it, you know, when I got into pro ball, you know, somebody would pull a hidden ball trick. And I would tell my dad about the hidden ball trick is that, and you get excited about it because it's a trick and it works and all that kind of stuff every once in a while. And my dad looked me in the eyes and said, there's no place for the hidden ball trick in professional baseball. That's amateur baseball. You know, because there's a certain pride in a way you go about it. You're not out there to try to embarrass the other guys. You're out there to outplay them and beat them. And so I always remember that. And there were a couple of times when people that came from other organizations tried to put a hidden ball trick on. I remember Juan Bonilla got a ball from right center field after a double, and he faked the throw back to our pitcher. And I'm standing on second base, and the guy's got his back to Juan Bonilla. And I see the ball didn't come in. And then I look at Juan Bonilla, and he goes, "Shh, like, don't tell anybody." So I walk up to the guy on second base, and I say, "Oh, don't move. Stay on second base. The second baseman has the ball." And he looks at me like, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "There's no place for the hidden ball trick in baseball." And I will tell you, once the ball is revealed, because it has to be put back in play, and the guy sees that I was right and I was true, he'd look at me and he would thank me because he didn't want to be embarrassed either way. So there's a certain projection of how you play the game. And I will tell you that there was some strategic advantage to that, because sometimes I would be able to ask that guy a question on second base, like, since when did they start putting hit and run on with Mark McGuire? And they would say, "Well, Mark McGuire sometimes gets take happy, and Skipper wants him to swing the bat. So he's not asking him to hit a ground ball. He just is trying to make him more aggressive." That information is pretty valuable when you're choosing who covers second base at different situations. So there's a sharing of information that naturally happens, but there's also a way that I thought the game was to be played. And I'm proud of the fact that other players and other teams really respected how I went about my job.
Well, Cal, you get the name Iron Man after all these years for mental toughness. Give us some mental toughness in the middle of this COVID here, man. I know we're missing baseball, we're missing sports, we're missing physical. I mean, I'm assuming you may have not have hugged your children. I mean, Don has not been able to hug his children or grandchildren. I think all of that, where we are right now and the strangeness of all this, we're going to remember this time in our lives. And I think mental toughness, and I know we had Don's sister on as a psychotherapist, just talking about taking care of ourselves in the middle of this mess, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It boils down to you play one game at a time. So that's what Dad used to always say. And I've been through some really tough times, and I've been through some really great times being able to win the World Series. But if you're going through 0-21, they fire your dad, you lose 100 games, it's a miserable sort of season, you could really get yourself mentally down. But you have to look for the positive aspects in this situation, in my opinion. Look at some of the things that you might be able to do that you wanted to do, like you wanted to read a little bit more. You wanted to exercise a little bit more. You wanted to do any number of things that sometimes your busy life doesn't allow you to do. I would look for the positives, and I would remember what Dad said. You know, don't look at the challenge, what's going to happen next week, what's going to happen the week after. Don't worry in the future. Worry about meeting the challenges of today. You know, what can I do today? Let me win today. And we'll worry about tomorrow when it gets here. I think that would be a good way to look at things. I know you get stir crazy. It's very difficult, and an analytical mind can wander. But I keep coming back to, okay, let's just focus on today. I tell you what, I personally have been way uplifted by our foundation. Our foundation came up with that idea to help with the food insecurity around the country. And as soon as that idea happened, it gave me sort of a mission. You know, sitting back here, I've done a bunch of interviews. I've encouraged a lot of people to help with the team. We've used our network in ways, you know, in a digital way that it feels like I have a sense of purpose sitting at home. So I would also encourage people just to find whatever that sense of purpose is and then go with it.
Well, we're going to be talking to the folks in the Maryland Food Bank next week as well. I want to give a shout-out to John Maroon, our longtime friend. You know, Don, a lot of people have a picture with Cal, and everybody's got Cal's autograph, right, whether it was on a popcorn box, as Cal sat there signing autographs. I have a picture at the top of the Great Wall of China with Cal Ripken.
Oh, yeah.
And there's not many people that can say that. So, you know, I always point that one out. That trip that we went on at the end of your career and, you know, obviously being around the world and all of that, does any of that strike back at you 13 years later? My wife and I went to Japan and over to South Korea about 4 months ago to chase you two around. And about South Korea and how much they love baseball. I mean, you and I were in the middle of Beijing. Nobody knew what baseball was, right? I mean, 13, 14 years ago. It's amazing how global it's become a dozen years later in so many ways in the World Baseball Classic, right?
Yeah, you know, that was a fantastic trip. And you describe it really well. You know, some things in life... the baseball has allowed us to do that. It allowed me to go over there in that capacity and conduct some clinics and introduce baseball to kids that didn't have it, you know, celebrate, you know, goodwill through sport, which was my job at the, at that particular time. But that was a fun trip, and that was a life experience, not just a baseball experience. It was a life experience. And I'm glad that you got a chance to enjoy it, and you maximized it, like nobody can by moving around. And, I remember how clear it was that day we went on the Great Wall of China, and we walked around and sometimes you feel like you're kind of a big fish in your little pond back here, but you realize the world is a huge ocean and there's a lot of stuff we haven't seen.
Well, yeah, man, and I'll never forget that day at the orphanage with the little girls, bro. Unbelievable.
That was cool.
Hey, man, thank you for your time, as always. And, Don, anything, any parting words for Cal, since you were completely shocked? Cal, let me tell you what. If I would have told him that you were coming on, he would have sent me a bio on you and highlight, because he's Mr. Prepared. So just dropping you in and saying, Cal, Don, Cal, we're going to talk to Cal. He had no prep, and it drives him crazy.
Yeah, that's true. You caught me off. But actually, I've got a quick question for Cal. With no prep, I want to see how close I am. But I'm telling you, you talk about – where we are and what we're doing. I'm looking over my desk. I have very little memorabilia, but I have 3 framed photos hanging right over my desk that I'm looking at right now. One is Cal Ripken Jr., one is Jim Palmer, and one is Brooks Robinson. So I think that's a pretty good Hall of Fame hanging over the desk right now. So just thanks for the memories, Cal. Cal, I want to see how close I am, because Nestor said I normally would have done research. He didn't let me do it. He surprised me, so I had to do this on the ring. How close am I if I say there was 1 year? You were setting these incredible fielding records, And in my brain, tell me how close I am to this. In my brain, there was a year where you made a total of 6 errors, and 3 of them were on throws, which means that out of the 500 or 600 chances, ground balls, you missed 3 ground balls in an entire season. Now, am I close to that, or am I hallucinating about that?
Yeah, you gave me twice as many errors as I deserved. I had 3 errors in that year. And I thought every one of the 3 areas was a bad official scores decision.
Of course you did.
So I went 100 games. I think Mike Bordick broke the consecutive errorless streak at shortstop in one of the years with the Orioles. But I went 95 or 96 games without an error. I made one against Cecil Fielder. I made one against George Brett. And I made a throw in the hole in Milwaukee where Mickey Telton was the first baseman. And it was a pretty good throw, but he had strided forward too soon, and he caught the ball and came off the base, and they gave me the error on that one. George Brett was a cue ball off the end of the bat where the third baseman didn't see it, and I tried to make a swipe at it on the turf. I had no chance, really. I could have just went out and picked it up, but they gave me an error on that one. And Cecil Fielder got jammed so bad in Detroit that the ball trickled past the pitcher, and I knew I had time, and it went over, and it hit some sort of mound, and it kicked up and hit me in the collarbone. And I still hurried to throw the ball, and it was a bang-bang play at first, but they called him safe, and they ruled an error on that one. So I think I could have gone the whole season without an error.
Well, I apologize for giving you 3-4 errors that you actually had. But I can remember, I said, yeah, he went the entire season really without missing a ground ball. It just, and how many, what do you normally average, Cal, about 600 chances a year?
Yeah, I would guess. I mean, there was one year where I had almost 600 assists. I broke the assist record for shortstop, so about 580 some, I think. And I had 900 chances that one year in 84. I won the Gold Glove a couple of years, but I thought there were other years where I was really deserving of it and got passed over.
Well, I know how private you are, man. You shared that picture, and I heard your dog bark a minute ago. You actually had the Gold Glove up on the. Somebody pointed it out in the picture, and I'm like, yeah, you know, Cal's chilling, watching 21-31, just like all of us. Hey, man, thanks for the time, and it's been a long, long time, and I tend to run into you. Every time I run into Cal, we're going to a Ravens game, or we're in the Green Bay Airport or something at 4 o'clock in the morning. But we all miss sports. We all miss baseball. We all miss some normalcy. It's been great to hear your voice and have some sense of normalcy, and hope to see you at a baseball game sometime soon, Cal.
Okay.
Thank you, Cal.
We'll see you, man. Appreciate
there he goes. Cal Ripken, Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, doing the Baltimore Positive thing. You can find me, Nasty, at Baltimore, Nasty at WNST.net or Ness at Baltimore Positive. I have 2 email addresses for the first time as well. We're keeping calm. We're staying local, and we're staying Baltimore Positive here at WNST.